What does it mean to be an American? It's almost a cliche to mention that all of us are immigrants. All of us have stories of coming to this nation, either ourselves or our ancestors, that to some extent inform how we feel about this country of ours, what sort of cultural traditions we have, what sort of family histories we have. But that doesn't stop us from talking about it, nor should it. These are important stories, indeed important enough that the Smithsonian Institution, in cooperation with a group called the Zocalo Public Square, has a website devoted to that very question, what it means to be an American.org. Recently, I happened upon an article there, and it turned out to be by one of my college classmates. And it turns out that she has a remarkable story. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about what it means to be an American.
Stay tuned for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
Bernice Glenn is a college classmate of mine. We were both members of the Princeton class of 1983, and indeed we took a number of meals together because we were members of the Princeton Tower Club as well. Hello, Tower folks. And recently, I came across Bernice, as I often do, because she is the class secretary and she posts frequently on the class Facebook page. This time it wasn't about another classmate, as it typically is. It was actually, I think it was another classmate posting about Bernice, and she'd written an article. And the article has a sort of long title, but it boils down to this. Here is my extremely interesting Hawaiian American Japanese family and the tale of how we got here. It was intriguing, it was fascinating, and as soon as I finished reading it, I gave Bernice a call.
Hi, Stuart. So I'm Bernice Glenn, and I work for an organization that looks for technologies for the Department of Defense, particularly in energy and energy-related fields. It's called the National Security Technology Accelerator. And I was brought up in Hawaii. I'm half Japanese, half Caucasian, and had a chance, an opportunity to grow up in Hawaii and go on for my education elsewhere.
Indeed, your education brought us together because the two of us were classmates in college, weren't we?
Exactly. Yes. It was a great opportunity for me, and I really enjoyed my time at Princeton. And the East Asian Studies Department was one of those unique departments where we had such a high concentration of faculty who were very devoted, as all faculty there are, to the undergraduates. But we just had a very small student body majoring in East Asian Studies, so we had a lot of individual attention, just as you did at the Woodrow Wilson School, just amazing professors. And one of them who was pivotal in helping me go to Japan in my junior year was at that time the head of the Wilson School, Dr. Levy, and just made all the difference in my life. So we were very lucky, you and I.
We were extraordinarily fortunate. In fact, though I didn't major in East Asian Studies, I do recall having taken one course, the title of which I believe was The History of the Chinese Revolution. And I'm sure it was from a faculty member who at least taught some in your department. I'm ashamed that I can't remember the fellow's name because it's a class that I still remember and still benefit from directly.
Possibly Lynn White. We had such great professors there. There were several that just were, especially in Chinese history, were outstanding. And I was very lucky because my first class that I took, and I really thought I was going to be a journalist, I took a class in medieval Japanese history, and I had an incredibly inspiring professor who revealed to me through the course that things that I thought were sort of psychological quirks about our family were actually culturally based and very deep-seated in Japanese history. So it does make a difference.
It's kind of like my wife's experience at Florida State University. She took a course in Southern literature, and it was taught by a woman who had been educated up north, and the professor kept commenting on how unrealistic Faulkner stories were or Flannery O'Connor stories were, and then one by one the students would raise their hands and say, "No, that's just like my Aunt Bertha." That's my Uncle Buck right there. And so, you're right. Oftentimes, truths are very apparent in the literature, but sometimes you have to dig a little bit to see how true they are. That's where our paths crossed. In fact, we were together in something that sounds really hoity-toity in the Tower Club, the eating club there along Prospect Street. But my recollection is that among these formerly aristocratic eating clubs, Tower was a real haven of very down-to-earth people who were very focused on their studies, but also very, very nice people.
Yes.
And I enjoyed being there.
I do, too. I have to tell you, one of the major draws initially, before I met the fabulous group of people who were there, was the library. I had a freshman seminar there, and I just fell in love with it. And
I think we probably spent many hours there sitting across from each other. I would often be studying in that lovely old library. It was a nice, quiet place. But at any rate, we could spend all the next hour reminiscing about all those wonderful halcyon days in college. But the particular connection that we have is actually what brought us to our topic today, because there is a Facebook page for the class of 1983 at Princeton, and whenever someone posts in it, I get a little notice. And you post there a lot. In fact, you're pretty involved in class activities.
Class secretary.
Yeah, you're a class secretary, so you're sort of in charge of all that. And one of your recent posts, or actually somebody else posting about you, involved a really, really poignant essay that you wrote on what it means to be an American. Could you tell us a little bit about that essay or how that essay came about?
Sure, and thank you so much. That's very kind. I had been involved in an event that the Zocalo Public Square organization had put on with the Smithsonian in Hawaii, and it was supported by the Daniel K. Inouye Foundation. I was very lucky in my life to have worked closely with the staff of Senator Inouye in economic development when I worked in that field in Hawaii. And so I had kept in close contact, certainly after the senator passed, was very involved in trying to make sure that many of the projects that he had initiated would be supported for many years. And so I had attended an event that was really the kickoff of this whole theme of what does it mean to be an American as a project by Zocalo Public Square and the lead organization. It was founded in LA in about 2003, and it's a digital daily. So they syndicate journalism to maybe about a little bit less than 300 media outlets, but they have a very clear mission to look at questions that are essential, especially to the American spirit. And so the lead person in my case, who contacted me, was Gary Rodriguez, and he was doing a little interview of everyone who was attending the event and asked us, you know, what is it in your family's history that makes you feel so strongly about being an American? And so I gave him almost, I guess, a summary of what I wrote about, and he asked me to write about it in more depth, and I almost couldn't initially. It was a little too... I didn't realize how strongly I felt about it. I started to write it and had to put it aside. And he came back and said, hey, you know, we're still really interested in your story. So I sat down, hunkered down, and had just gone through Berkeley on a trip as I was starting to spend more time in California, which brought me closer to my family roots in Berkeley and the Buddhist temple there. And sat down and wrote this, and then they posted it as part of their series. So that's how that that particular article came about.
And it's a very, very moving article. I should mention, and regular listeners would already know this, that we have done several episodes focused upon the very, very constitutional issue of the Japanese-American incarcerations that took place during World War II after Pearl Harbor. We did an episode on Manzanar where I visited the concentration camp there. We've done a couple of episodes on the Korematsu case. We did an episode on Tule Lake. We did an episode on Kermit Roosevelt's book, Allegiance, which is based on the same period. So it's something that we definitely have spent a fair amount of time talking about. But what struck me when I read your piece was that those are all about the low point of many Japanese American families. That's about the discrimination that they suffered and the immediate and long-term consequences of it. What your essay did was go the other way. It went back in time, and it showed just how deep the roots of your family are in the United States and also in Japan. And so if I might ask, could we go ahead and start that that story? And let's start it as far back as you want to, but let's take it forward in time and talk about those roots rather than about the bad times.
Sure, gladly. So both of my grandparents came from very long lineages within the Buddhist community. And we have the advantage of, as a family with ties to the temple, we have access to the temple family histories. And temples in Japan in particular are quite good at keeping track of family history. And so both of my grandparents' histories actually start in non-Buddhist roots. So my grandfather's family came from a retainer of a lord who was on the western seacoast of Japan, who was a feudal lord, and who, when he was defeated in a very dramatic way, asked my ancestor to not be part of the inner group to commit suicide, but rather to become the priest, take over the family temple, become the priest to look over the souls of the dead and the living going forward. And that was the start of what then became 18 generations of Buddhist bishops in my family on my grandfather's side.
And 18 generations? I can't even do the math. What was the rough time? What was the rough time that this all occurred?
So we trace our family on both sides back to about the 12th century.
Good heavens.
And my grandmother's side is much more easy to trace because her family started, again, as feudal lords. They were actually part of the shogunate, and the shogunate that they were part of was the Ashikaga shogunate. And they came into power and lost power between the 12th and 17th centuries. And so her family also, upon defeat, became Buddhist priests and then bishops and then abbots and became very powerful within the Buddhist community. So powerful that at one point the government split their sect into East and West. It's called the Honganji sect, and they split them into Higashi and Nishi sects. So that's East and West sects, and that was to diminish the power of the church because it was becoming politically very powerful. So that's the background of where they start. But my grandfather was educated during the Meiji period at a place called Keio University, a private university, well known for its westernization movement, led by a scholar called Fukuzawa Yukichi. And Fukuzawa Yukichi was very well known in Japan as being a very pro-Western scholar who focused on what it meant to blend East and West, in his words, how you could become very open and embrace Western ideals of democracy and still be Japanese in culture and in mindset. And so he was my grandfather's mentor. And my grandfather traveled with him to places like Dejima, which is an old Dutch outpost when Japan was in its isolationist period, where they limited foreigners to that area through Japan, and spent a lot of time really focusing on democracy. And in fact, my grandfather ended up writing a book called Buddhism and Democracy and the American Perspective of Democracy. And that was his way of distilling what elements of Buddhism and its values directly align with the values of American democracy.
Well, you come by your family values honestly. This seems to go back a long way.
Yes, yes. It's very strongly felt, and you know, through all of the cousins and everyone today, but I think our grandparents and our parents' generation really were in positions and took action to actively bridge at, as you say it, before the low point and through the low point and afterwards.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Bernice Glenn, the author of a recent article on the Smithsonian-sponsored website, What It Means to Be an American. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Bernice Glenn. Stick around. It looks like the quiz guy.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing extremely well, Doug. How about you?
I'm doing great.
You have a quiz for us today?
I do have a quiz.
Tremendous. Well, maybe we have a contestant for you today. Who is on the line?
Hi, it's Kelvin.
Kelvin? Not yes. Celsius. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. Kelvin, where are you from?
Fahrenheit. No, Lebanon, Tennessee.
Good one, Kelvin. From Lebanon, Tennessee. Where is Lebanon, Tennessee? What part of the state is that in?
That's about 30 miles east of Nashville.
30 miles east of Nashville. That's a beautiful part of the state.
Yeah.
It really is. Gorgeous, in fact. You're driving out I-40 that way, all the mountains and the rolling scenery. But I digress. Are you ready to do a quiz, sir?
Sure.
Okay. Doug, are you ready to give Kelvin a quiz?
I am. I'm going to, Kelvin, ask you a question and give you four choices.
Okay.
Are you ready?
All right.
Cody Brown and his wives are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to reconsider a famous marriage case. What would be the key issue in the case? Would it be A, common law or cohabitual status in the consideration for taxes? B, religious-based polygamy? C, Obergefell versus Hodges legalizing gay marriage? Or D, outlawing state employees from being able to deny marriage licenses? To same-sex couples.
Kelvin?
I'm going to say B, polygamy.
Polygamy. Doug?
You're right, Kelvin. It's religious, and I'm guessing that the way the question was asked, Cody Brown and his wives.
Well, I ask you to repeat your questions, Doug, but I thought that was a bit of a strong clue.
It's interesting. The Supreme Court has not heard a polygamy case since 1878.
The Reynolds case.
And that's exactly right.
Right.
But, you know, it seems as though sister wives are all the rage because of reality TV.
Right.
And now Cody Brown and his wives, they're going to make a run at it.
They're going to make a run at it. That's a really fascinating case. The Reynolds case was back in the day, back in the 19th century.
This was a Mormon church official.
Right.
George Reynolds.
Right, an extremely important case, and it was one where the court considered the general question of when you've got a law, like in that case, the federal bigamy law, that outlawed so-called plural marriage, actually made it a crime, and that law is not specifically directed at a religious minority, it's just a generally applicable law, but then a religious minority raises its hand and say, wait a second, your neutral, generally applicable law affects negatively my religious exercise. What do you do? Do you have to give them what's called an accommodation, or perhaps an exemption is a better term for it? Or do they have to obey the law? And in Reynolds, they said, you have to obey the law. And then the court's gone all over the map since that time. But back in 1990, they said the same thing. So the law currently is, since the Smith case in 1990, the law currently is the same as it was in the Reynolds case, which is no, if the law really isn't directed at a religious minority, if it really is neutral, then you do have to obey it. Now, people are going to get confused because Congress came along and voluntarily said, at least with regard to federal laws, that they were going to grant accommodations. That's very oversimplified, but that's basically what it is. And those are the so-called RFRAs, or the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. And then a bunch of states have enacted them. So this area of law is notoriously muddy.
Mm-hmm,
but
sure.
The Constitution and the Free Exercise Clause is at least clear all the way back, in 1990 and then earlier in the Reynolds case.
It's interesting. We keep having these challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And the really fundamental question is, if you can claim faith, should you be able to do anything you want to do.
As the Reynolds Court said, that would make every man a law unto himself. I think that's a direct quote. I mean, and seriously, you know, whenever this issue's come up, I've said, okay, if we go to that thing, if these guys win, or these women and this one guy win, then I'm going to form the first church of, I don't know, cocaine, right? And then I will say it's part of my religious right. I have to take a snort in order to see God. Well, then how can they say that's not legitimate, right? And then I'm a law unto myself. And if you can exempt yourself from all sorts of laws simply by claiming a religious faith, which no one really can question, then where are you left?
Yeah, I mean, you very, very easily could start having businesses denying their employees or their customers access to things like healthcare,
right,
based on religious principles.
You could, but here's, not to belabor this point, they may have a stronger argument under equal protection and under fundamental rights theory of the due process clause, building upon the Obergefell case, because the Obergefell case, which legalized gay marriage, is one in a long line of cases that has been advancing gay rights, and many people read those cases broadly to give great freedom and great protection to people who want to live in so-called alternate lifestyles, such as polygamists.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I can almost see where this is headed, which is that the state should probably get out of the religion business.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these relational contracts should be seen as just that.
And
they are contracts.
If they are, then it's a matter of equality.
Yeah, that's right. And if people of faith want to get together in a house of worship and they want to celebrate that contract,
mm-hmm.
they're free to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, should the state be in the marriage business, or should it only see those relationships only as contracts?
A question for another day, but a very, very interesting one. So thank you very, very much, Kelvin. You got it right. So send us an email to ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size, and we will send you not only a T-shirt of the appropriate size, but a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. Thanks for playing.
All right, thank you.
Absolutely, and Doug, thank you.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And in this election year, when we've talked so much about immigration and walls and what it means, perhaps, to be an American, it occurred to me that a story on that subject would be appropriate. And so I'm speaking with a college classmate of mine. Her name is Bernice Glenn. Bernice recently wrote a piece that was on a website sponsored by the Smithsonian all about what it means to be an American. Before the break, she was telling me about her Japanese family, her mother's side of the family that goes back a number of centuries in Japan and was involved with establishing Buddhist temples in Hawaii. Now we're going to talk about how those families, her father's family and her mother's family, came together. When did the contacts between your Japanese branch and your American branch begin?
Well, it really started with my grandfather being sent to Hawaii to help set up a temple for Japanese immigrant workers. And so this is in the late 1800s when waves of immigrants were being brought in to work in the sugar and pineapple plantations in Hawaii. And the Chinese wave had hit first, the Japanese followed, the Portuguese as well. And the Japanese immigrant workers sent there were bachelors, they were men, sometimes they were fathers and grandfathers who had been sent to Hawaii with the ideal of earning enough to send money back to Japan and to return to Japan someday. And Japan's economy had completely crumbled in the agricultural sector, and so there was diminishing base of resources, and this was Japan's way of trying to send their most able-bodied men to other countries and to send money back home. And what was unknown at that time was that the Japanese economy would continue to be poor, and that those first-generation Japanese immigrants would never have the chance to return home. And so my grandfather, anyway, was sent as sort of an assistant to a man who was supposed to be the first Buddhist bishop in Hawaii. And he was, for a very short time, became ill, went back to Japan, and my grandfather, at 30-some years old, became the bishop of Hawaii. And he was in a way, perfectly positioned for it. He was about 6 foot tall. He spoke English fluently. He had been an English and economics professor, as well as a Buddhist bishop. Now, in his new role, he wore these white linen suits with white buckskin shoes when he met with plantation owners, and he wore his Buddhist robes when he met with the immigrant workers. And so he had an idea very early on of how he could support the first generation, and his main goal was to make sure that their children would become Americans and would never have to work in the fields like they did.
I see. And then he met someone here, I'm guessing, in Hawaii? Who became your grandmother?
No. So these things, in especially our lineage in Japan, never happen by happenstance. So there was a period where he had been married before his wife had died. He was now bishop of this Hawaii temple that was positioned to grow by leaps and bounds. And he came back to Japan to reestablish his mission with the main temple before he launched out on his own to really push the envelope on what an American Buddhist temple community would be like and how far that reach would be. And so he was about to embark on a mission where he was being given an incredible amount of freedom, but they did want to have him come back once to become very anchored in how they envisioned the support of Japanese immigrants could occur. And at that time, my great-great aunt, who was the founder of Kyoto Women's University, she was a great women's leader in Japan, had been asked to look for a match for this 30-some-year-old bilingual leader who was rather charismatic and very pro-Western. And she chose one of her nieces. And that was my grandmother. And she had been working with and cultivating her niece to ensure that she spoke English, that she had an understanding of Western ideals, not for the marriage, but because that's also what my great-great-grandaunt believed in. And so this niece seemed perfectly suited, and they had an arranged meeting where she served him tea. I believe my grandmother was 17 or 18, and my grandfather was 32 or something. And she served him tea, probably spoke, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 words with each other. And after he left, my great-grandaunt said, well, you know, that man is going to become the bishop in Hawaii, and he's going to spend his life in America. Would you want to marry him? And my grandmother said, hi, which is yes. And that, she said, years later, she said her whole life just, you know, took a complete turn after just saying very quickly, yes, of course. And she never looked back. She was very happy with her life, as it turned out. And they were very well suited for each other.
That is remarkable. I'm sure not every, certainly not every marriage works out that way, and not every arranged marriage either, but that's a charming story. So then they came back to Hawaii, I'm guessing.
Yes, so he came back first, and then she followed, and he...
What year was this, roughly? Let's root this in chronology again.
Sure. So he had gone originally to Hawaii in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. She followed him in the early 1900s.
Okay.
This is maybe about, just to be clear, this was maybe about early 1900, I'd say roughly about maybe 1902-ish.
Okay.
And so then they start to build these temples. It ended up that he built 36 temples throughout the state of Hawaii, which was not a state then. So mm-hmm. It was part of the Kingdom of Hawaii. And
again, you're going to have to forgive me because I'm not really as up on my Hawaiian history as I should be, but it still had not been annexed into the United States at that point, had it?
Exactly. And an interesting side note on that, my grandfather had become very close to a woman by the name of Mary Foster, who was a very strong supporter of Buddhism and also a member of the Hawaiian monarchy. She was what would probably be the equivalent of a countess, and she had, at the annexation, had been very close to Queen Liliuokalani, who was overthrown during the annexation, and who had gone through some very chaotic personal psychological trauma because of the overthrow. And so Mary Foster would bring her to the temple, and hoping that somehow Buddhism would help salve her distress. And my grandfather wrote in his diaries later that she asked him if she should convert to Buddhism, and he said, absolutely not. You know, you have a very strong belief in Christianity, but let Buddhism teach you how to value that Christianity and those beliefs, because there's, you know, great solace that you'll gain from becoming more anchored in what you know. And so it was an interesting sort of interfaith approach. Mm-hmm. And it was a very tumultuous time, of course, for Native Hawaiians you know, all of these waves of immigrants. And the Native Hawaiian community had been and continues to be an incredible force in creating a climate where each wave of immigrants were accepted. And in fact, intermarriage was immediately embraced by the Native Hawaiian community, and acceptance of religions. And without that host culture acceptance, Hawaii would have been a very different place, highly segregated, and you wouldn't see the type of interracial marriage and cultural sharing that you see there now, which is truly, it's not really a melting pot, but it's very close. It's many, many, many layers of intersection across all the different ethnicities. So anyway, that was the framework of the timing, was that this was still, Hawaii was still part of the Kingdom of Hawaii. They saw the annexation occur.
And when did the annexation occur?
Actually, now that I think of it, it's 1893, so it was a little bit earlier than what I originally thought.
Okay, and that's right.
So.
All right, so that's when the annexation was occurring, so your granddad was already there.
Yes.
He witnessed that. He saw the anguish that the queen went through. They had their discussions about Buddhism and Christianity. He goes back to Japan. He gets his wife. She comes over in the early 1900s. He continues his temple building and his outreach. And what happens next?
Then they have a son who is Kamo Imamura. He was born in 1904 in Honolulu. So he then is going to be the next leader of the family temple in Fukui, which is on the western seacoast of Japan. So
they're going to send him back to Japan.
Yeah, so this is the hardest part of the whole thing. They mm-hmm. were so pro-Western and so focused on how do we grow second generation leaders who know both about Japan and America, and how do we make them relevant to both countries and to Buddhism as a global religion.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Bernice Glenn, a woman with a very, very interesting ancestry. She's half American, half Japanese, and she spent most of her life, indeed her family spent most of its existence, in the Pacific island of Hawaii. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Bernice Glenn. Stick around.
The constitutional formula of divided sovereignty had been the work of compromise and concession within the Constitutional Convention, but it later became a cause of celebration and pride for Madison toward the end of his life. He boasted that the Constitution was totally unique, and no other government can furnish a key to its true character. Other governments present an individual and indivisible sovereignty. The Constitution of the United States divides the sovereignty. Naysayers had denied that such a system was possible, but the Constitution was designed to prove them wrong. Quote, If sovereignty cannot be thus divided, the political system of the United States is a chimera, mocking the vain pretensions of human wisdom. If it can be so divided, the system ought to have a fair opportunity of fulfilling the wishes and expectations which cling to the experiment. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're continuing our story with Bernice Glenn, all about the fascinating history of her family, a history that spans the entire Pacific Ocean. Before the break, Bernice was talking about her uncle, who, consistent with the family tradition, was about to be trained to become a Buddhist priest.
My grandparents both had wanted him to be educated in America, in Hawaii, and they came up. This is probably the one area where they came up against the traditional sort of bulwark of Buddhism education and educators at that time in Japan. And they were strongly overruled by that group that said, you know, there are no training facilities in Hawaii. That's why you're there, is to actually start these. But you don't have them at the ready yet, and you need to ensure for the lineage that your son is groomed in the core basics of Buddhism, but also understands where the Japanese side comes from. He needs to learn Sanskrit. He needs to have, you know, very intensive training so that by a very young age, he can be a priest in order to become a bishop at a nominal age in his maybe 30s or so. So they gave in, and they sent him back to Japan, to that family temple. Again, it's on the eastern Japan seacoast, so it's really windy and cold and wet in the winters. And my grandmother, who is now pregnant with their second child, took him to Japan. And
how old was he at the time?
He was four.
Oh, gee. Oh, my gosh. So, sending a four-year-old away for, I'm guessing, years?
Yes, for years. And So she's pregnant with her second child, and the plan had always been to have each child born in America. So she's cutting it kind of close because she's pregnant. She's taking him to Japan. She can't bear to leave him there, and he's going to be brought up by priests and by a very cold step-grandmother who has very little interest in this child, but she's the only one who's still alive of that generation whose role it is to run the temple. So my grandmother sees this, and as a mother, she can't do it. And she lingers and she lingers and she lingers, and she's being really pushed to leave so that her second child will be born in America. And she can't do it. This is her precious firstborn. She just can't do it. And she ends up having her second child in Japan.
Oh, man. Before we go into the constitutional issue, I'll simply say I'm with Grandma. I don't know if I could leave a four-year-old child. I just don't know if I could do it. In fact, I'm kind of wondering how Granddad felt back in Hawaii. That must have been very rough for all of them. But, of course, the issue here is that Section 1 of the 14th Amendment gives birthright citizenship.
Yes.
To anyone born in the United States or presumably in that territory as well. And I suspect that's going to become an issue later in our saga.
Exactly.
But please continue.
So she finally has to leave, and she's now spent months and months and months there, and she's recuperating after the birth of her second child, and she is now being really forced by the entire community that says, you know, we have the schools here, he is safe here, he will learn what he needs to learn, and you know, your mission is bigger than this. Your mission is to be the wife of the bishop, and so you must lead the community in Hawaii. Your mission is not here to take care of your child. So she leaves him, and he, many years later, when I spoke with him about it, he said, you know, he would be walking from the main hall to the study area where he was going to be studying and tested by these priests alone. He's the only one in this school, basically, that they've created for him. And at age 9, he becomes a priest. And he as he would walk along the area, the long open hallway between the two buildings and the cold wind is whipping up through his little child's priest robes, he kept thinking, why am I here and my family's in Hawaii? You know, what have I done that puts me in this position? And it really haunted him for years, feeling, you know, on the one hand, that he was very privileged to have all of this, and on the other hand, feeling very lonely from an early age. So he understood people who felt lonely in a very profound way. Anyway,
I guess so. And this was your grandfather?
No, so this is my uncle.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. We were been talking about your grandfather earlier, and this is your uncle yeah. who's the priest. Okay, got it. Yeah.
So going back to my grandparents then, my grandmother returns with this second child who is born in Japan. She returns with him to Hawaii and proceeds to have more children. And she ends up, they end up with three boys and three girls. And so the oldest one is in Japan. The rest are growing up in Hawaii. And my grandfather...
Just so that I'm clear, Bernice, now which one of these eventually ends up being your father or mother?
Oh, so the second to the youngest girls is my mother.
Now I've got the lineage straight. Okay.
Yes.
now go back to your story then, please.
So my grandfather in the meantime has now set up these, wherever there is a large plantation, he would negotiate with the plantation owners to set up not only a temple, but also to have space devoted to a school, and the school would teach both Japanese language and English language, and would focus on really emphasizing what it means to be an American. So these children are being taught to have a foot in both cultures and languages and history and culture in a very deep way, not a superficial way. And they're many of them have dorms, because a lot of the immigrant families way out in the neighbor islands did not have the means to support their children. And so the dorms were places where students could help out with chores or help with the temple. And in exchange, they would have room and board and activities and school. And they could see their parents occasionally when they could be sent for them, or when they would come into wherever the dorms were. And there are dorms throughout the islands, but the main dorms were on the main island of Oahu. And so my grandfather negotiated with the plantation owners based on his background in economics, and he would show them the cost, for example, of what they were the most afraid of, which was a strike. Because the conditions were not good, and because the pay was not good, and because they knew that that was a big possibility. So he would lay out the cost of, you know, a 2 to 3 day strike versus giving them land where my grandfather would raise the money to build the temples and the schools. And so that's why it was fairly easy for him to set up so many schools and temples and dorms. So he does that, and in the meantime, they have the rest of their children who go through a typical second-generation Japanese-American Hawaii experience. They end up, almost all of them, going to McKinley High School, which was kind of the premier public high school at that time on Oahu, where there were a lot of Japanese-Americans. They form very tight bonds. And then the education of the older ones begins. The second son, who was born in Japan, goes to Harvard, and he goes to Harvard as an undergraduate, and then on to business school. And the next child goes on to Smith, and then the next three are getting ready to enter college. The third one is a boy, and he goes back to Japan to go to Keio University, the same university that my grandfather went to. And then my grandfather, this is in the 1930s.
Well, before you go on any further, I just have to comment, you're obviously from a family of slackers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to all the top universities for men and women that are available to them, even though they are, some of them, practically on the other side of the planet.
Yes.
So good for them.
Well, you know, they were an example of a lot of Japanese Americans, Nisei at that time, and the stars of the schools that he had started, sort of the top students, were often sent with scholarships that the Japanese American community created. They pooled their monies and they sent people to Harvard and University of Chicago. And, you know, that was the whole intent, was to, as in Hawaii culture, we say hui, to pool your resources together and support that next generation to go on. And so that's what they did. So thank you for saying that. But they were, you know, sort of just, they were just part of a wave of people like that. There are some amazing Japanese Americans who came out of really the poorest conditions and ended up becoming like the first Japanese American federal judge and the first Japanese American doctor and things like that. But yeah, I think the emphasis and the values were very clear in that community, which is that education is everything, and that, you know, you go on to make the place better than you found it. So that's kind of what drove it. So anyway, we had then we had these first four kids are now all in college, and in my oldest uncle's situation, he also went to Keio University, but he was very involved in his own schooling and development as a Buddhist priest. And so my...
Just for the geographically challenged, is Keio University, is that in Kyoto?
No, so Keio is in Tokyo.
In Tokyo, okay. You had mentioned Kyoto before, so I thought perhaps it was there. Okay.
Yes. So my grandmother's side of the family came from Kyoto, and her great-great-aunt was the founder of the Kyoto Women's University. And that was really based on looking at Christian women's universities and wondering why in Buddhism they didn't have Buddhist women's universities. So she started one.
There's a solution. Let's just do it.
Right. And I've visited many times now. I go back every year, and it now goes from kindergarten through graduate school. It has a law school and a medical school. And so it's really
Is
quite...
it still a women's university?
It is, yes. It's still a women's university.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Okay, but Keio is in Tokyo, and that's where one of your uncles was going. Okay.
Yes. So, and he was, so the first one is a priest. The second one had gone to Harvard and was focused on business and government. He really was interested in government service, but he also had a strong business background. And the third one that went to Keio is wanted to be a journalist. So they're all kind of taken care of. And my oldest aunt is at Smith, so she's kind of locked into her track. And that leaves my mother and her sister, who are much younger than everyone else. They were, I think, over 20 years younger than my oldest uncle. So it's quite an age span between these six.
They were bonus babies.
They were. It's so funny that you would say that, because my mother said that they would refer to them as change of life babies, and my grandfather was extremely proud that he had kids that way. Yeah.
Well, okay for granddad, but I would say grandma had a bit of a bit of something to do with it as well. Yeah, those bonus babies are not always the most welcome of developments. This is, in case you're listening, honey, I'm telling my wife, I think I'm very happy with our two, and I think we can stop there. All right, but back to your family. So on here they are. It's 20 years after everybody else, and so your mother and her sister are still at home, I'm guessing.
Yes, they are. And they are, they're typical Hawaiianese say kids. They run around in their muumuus and bare feet sometimes, and then their mother would dress them up for, you know, occasions where they would be very stiff in their very Western style outfits, and then they would also wear kimono, you know, at different festivals and stuff. So they're brought up in a very carefree Hawaii-based environment. At that time, my grandfather now is very well-positioned in terms of the temples running themselves, and he's starting to look at the expansion of Buddhism, which has already taken place on the mainland. There have already been temples established in California and other places, but he starts to work very closely with the heads of all of those temples to envision what Buddhism as a more global religion could look like in the context of American ways of life, and how to make it more palatable and sort of mesh with American ways of life. So he started based on the YMCA model. He starts the YMBA.
YMBA. I've never heard of it. Forgive me. Okay.
I know. And they start.
Someone needs to do a disco song about it.
Exactly. It's a little harder.
We all know about it. We'll do a dance. Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. The B part is really hard. You have to contort.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it would be. Yeah.
Oh, I hate to interrupt this fascinating story at this point, but we have a whole other episode we're going to devote to it, and we really couldn't fit it all into the next few minutes anyway. So I thought I'd take a couple of minutes and introduce a new feature, one that I was inspired to create. Along with a good buddy of mine. Her name is Anne Walsh Long. She is a librarian at the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University, where I work. And one day when I was speaking with Anne, she and I figured out that librarians are privy to some of the best legal information out there. In fact, they get regular updates of interesting cases, things that Anne always passes along to me. But then I thought one day, why doesn't she pass them along to you? And thus was born what Anne calls stack quotes. And indeed, she calls herself Library Anne.
Run them down. This was a tweet from Instapundit Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at the University of Tennessee College of Law and columnist for USA Today. He tweeted, "Run them down," in response to a Charlotte news advisory alerting motorists to avoid protesters on I-277 who were stopping traffic. The protesters had taken to the streets to protest the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott, a black man shot by a black police officer, Brentley Vinson. Reynolds' three-word tweet had generated quite a firestorm from civil rights supporters. One group supports the civil right of free speech, and the other group supports the civil right of a guarantee of equal protection under the law. So who is right? Did Reynolds go too far by tweeting a potentially violent suggestion? Or are the actions of the protesters to blame for taking to the streets in a violent manner? Whose civil rights are protected? Today's stat quote comes from Stephen H. Schifrin, a law professor at Cornell and author of the book What's Wrong with the First Amendment? In a chapter about race, Schifrin writes about how publicly blatant racist speech has long been socially unacceptable and yet constitutionally protected. He has evaluated the data collected on racial polarization and concluded that the vision of a post-racial society that many expected after the election of President Obama has instead been one with the greatest racial tension and conflict since the 1960s and early 1970s. Schifrin comments about the American value of committing to free speech and says that this commitment has already been compromised in many ways, including defamation, obscenity, copyright, fraud, perjury, and some forms of indecent speech. If free speech can be compromised in a clash with reputation or morality, it is not clear why it should be privileged when clashes with racial equality, order, and the avoidance of deliberately induced trauma. Moreover, if it is attractive to maintain an American identity placing emphasis on free speech, it is also attractive to foster an American identity of racial equality and an anti-racist public morality. Schifrin's book was published in September and suggests that the First Amendment has been placed on so high a pedestal that it is almost automatically privileged over privacy, fair trials, and equality, and it suggests that the free speech extremism is the product of political ideologies that developed after the 1950s. Schifrin concludes his chapter on race by stating, "Although the United States does not constitutionalize the value of multiculturalism, the Civil War produced the 14th Amendment's commitment to equality, and one can appropriately weave a national narrative in which the country moves toward the goals of equality and democratic inclusion by repudiating slavery, obliterating Jim Crow, affording greater equality rights to women, and to those whose sexual orientation stretches beyond the heterosexual. The country has far to go, but we do not have to achieve perfect equality before we recognize that stigmatized groups deserve protection from many forms of hateful speech." This is Library Anne with the Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law with today's stat quote.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Bernice Glenn for sharing the first part of her family's story with us. We'll have part two next week. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell. And Anne Walsh Long does our stat quote, our new feature this week. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.